Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to episode 3 of Blue Jays Happy Hour. I'm Nick Ashbourne, and I'm joined, as always, by Andrew Stoughton. And we have a very brief history in this podcast, but for the first time, I think the moment in Blue Jays land lives up to the name Blue Jays Happy Hour. They are coming off a sweep. I think that the vibe surrounding the Toronto Blue Jays might be at an all-time high for the season. They've always been a little bit dampered, especially with the Springer situation, but for the first time, it seems like people are feeling really good about this team. Stoughton, where are you at with the general Blue Jays mood?
Yeah, I'm feeling really good about this team. It's taken a while to get here, for sure. I think Bo Bichette said on Thursday night or Thursday afternoon after the game, not everybody has been hitting at the same time. Like, they haven't been getting production from everyone at the same time. They're starting to sort of feel like maybe they're doing that now. And I think that definitely adds to it. Ryu going out and pitching like Ryu is always good. Ross Stripling going out and pitching like the way he did.
Real competence from Ross Stripling, especially after the first couple batters of that game, where you're thinking like, what is Ross Stripling doing out here? What are we going to have to suffer through? And you got to give him credit. He really turned that around.
He did. I mean, I had some scathing takes ready to go. Like, midway in the first inning, I was just like copy and pasting tweets where everybody was ready to DFA him right there on the spot. And then he was great. It was unexpected. And I don't think I'm going to expect it going forward, but
no, I don't think you should, but it's okay to appreciate a moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's weird. They had the weird hiccup with Nate Pearson, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But now they got another guy, which I'm sure we'll talk about as well. Which is kind of like,
yeah, last
helping
week
to balance
we
out the universe.
We were all Manoah and Pearson, and there's going to be a little repetition this week. But that's just the way it is.
But yeah, it's I know we're gonna talk about some individual guys, I'm sure. But yeah, Bichette and Marcus Semien just sort of sneaking up on everybody, having a great year when it really didn't feel for, you know, the first several weeks of the season that he was having a great year. Like, he felt it was like he was competent. It wasn't great. The defense has been good, but now you suddenly look and him and Bichette have identical numbers.
Yeah, it's like with Semien, I feel like when he was struggling, people maybe weren't critical enough. Not like they needed to be super critical, but I don't think people really were internalizing how badly he was struggling for a time. And I feel like as he started to get hotter, people aren't paying quite enough attention to how good he's been lately. Like, he's been their best hitter for a little while now.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I mean, Vlad had his little run, and I think, what is it, a 12-game hitting streak for Semien now, and I think it's 18 of 19 he's got hits, and there've been multi-hit games in there, and he just looks like everything's going way better. And that sort of fits with what he sort of seemed to think, like he needs more time to get going than some guys, and that was maybe why last year didn't go as well for him. He just needs to get in a groove, like
the Frank Thomas. You need to have the 100 plate appearances.
And you know, and that's why he got a lot of plate appearances in the spring, I think, to try to combat that a bit. And lo and behold, here we are. A lot of season left, but you feel real good about where Semien is at. And I think a lot of these guys, I mean, Gurriel isn't really yet going, but he's hit a little bit lately, or he's, you know, put some good swings. Danny Jansen had, you know, those three home runs in a row. I don't know if that was before last week's podcast or not. I can't remember. his weighted runs created plus is positive as opposed to negative, which is still terrible. Like, but
he's in pitcher territory, but he's in like good hitting pitcher territory.
That's right.
Now. The guys who are like, oh, he could get a single here.
Yeah, and then Teoscar obviously is looking. It's so strange how he went down on the COVID list for 10 days. He had COVID or whatever. I don't know what the hell happened there, but he couldn't do anything basically. And then he came back and he's just been, you know, the Silver Slugger version of Teoscar, which he had not been before.
Yeah, I think Hernandez is probably the guy who stands out the most to me in this last little run. So in the 13 games since he's been back, you know, he's hitting 360, 429, 620. Like, absolutely crushing the ball. Like, exit velocity around 92 miles per hour, right where he normally is. And the thing that's crazy to me about what he's doing right now is his ability to avoid strikeouts. Because even, like, good Teoscar Hernandez, really good Teoscar Hernandez, is striking out close to 30% of the time. I know we're talking about a 13-game sample here, but 12% strikeouts over a 13-game sample is, I'm looking at it here, it's significantly the lowest he's ever had. The lowest I can find in another 13-game sample is 21.6 strikeout rate. So, like, you can say this is all a tiny little run, and obviously he's probably not going to do this all year round. Like, he's not DJ LeMahieu, but that says something to me that his, you know, his discipline, his ability to make contact, something is going on with Teoscar Hernandez. And if he can give you, like, what he gave you last year, that's already exceeding expectations. If there's even something else in that bat, combined with the guys they're going to have hitting in front of him, that could be really exciting.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think you sort of see, you know, we saw Rowdy Tellez have that last year where he stopped striking out nearly as much. And, you know, this year he's a bit lost, but that was a good thing. Randall Grichuk is another guy who, you know, the strikeout rate just keeps coming down, and it seems like it's an organizational thing. I know I've written about this. I probably talked about it already on one of our episodes too, but like Dante Bichette last fall talking about just hitting philosophy in general and a lot of the individual guys. It was all about two-strike approach and, you know, kind of the stuff you see in Bo and about, you know, letting the ball get in deep. But also one of the things he said was that, you know, there's going to be weeks where for a lot of these guys, the game's easy and they go on a tear, and it's about, you know, what they do in the time in between those times and really focusing on, you know, trying to add in walks and hits whenever they can. But I think walks was a big thing and talking about two strike approach. I think he said that like the whole league hits 160 with two strikes, and his advice to Grichuk was like, you can hit more than 160 with two strikes, and you're kind of laughing after that, because then, you know, everybody without two strikes is pretty good. And I, you know, I don't want to put too much into especially Dante in particular, because obviously there's a lot of people that deserve credit, and the hitters in particular, but like Guillermo Martinez and Dave Hudgens, and you know, they're it's more than just one guy, but he obviously sort of has a lot of gravity because of his history in the game, because he's Bo's dad. But he's a really interesting guy to hear speak about that stuff, and which is why I keep coming back to it. And just to see it sort of manifest itself in the performances is encouraging, because it sort of makes me think that it's not a fluke that a guy like Teoscar, a guy like Tellez, a guy like Grichuk is seeing success in that way, because it's in the way that he was talking a year ago about, you know, trying to get them to that point.
And when you have hitters like that, I think it's easy to conceptualize there being this firm trade-off of, if you're going to hit for power, you're going to need to swing for the fences, and that's going to result in more strikeouts. And there is a relationship there, absolutely. But it's not a perfect relationship. And, you know, Randall Grichuk is a good example, because he's someone who has lost a little bit of power in the last couple of years compared to sort of the StatCast darling he used to be, compared to some of the isolated slugging numbers he used to put up. But what he's gained in taking that strikeout rate down has been significantly more. And if Teoscar Hernandez, and we're very early in this process, and I don't want to promise that he's a new hit or anything, but if he can do some of that, I think that he'll gain a lot more than he loses, because especially him, because his natural power is unbelievable. Like, he clears the fences by a ton. So if he's not swinging quite as hard, or if he reins himself in a little bit more, and, you know, I think he's someone, if he's fully healthy this year, I would have projected him for mid-30s home runs, maybe 40s home runs. Like, I was a big believer in what he did, especially because of the way he was at the end of 2019. Like, it wasn't just a 2020 sample. If that comes down to, you know, I don't know, if your projection of 38 comes down to 31 or 32, but the walk rate is up and but he's collecting a lot more hits because he's striking out fewer times, that's a trade-off you're going to make 10 times out of 10.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And it's exciting to see what they're able to do right now. Obviously things starting to click. Obviously it won't go on forever, but then you get Springer back too, which is he's pretty good, as we saw when like the 85% version of him, or maybe less, came in and just, you know, single-handedly won that game in the previous sweep of Atlanta.
Yeah, and you also have guys who haven't. I mean, you know, is Vladdy going to come down a little bit from where he is? Probably. You know, Semien, his stat line right now, I could see him keeping that up. Bichette, I could see him keeping up approximately where he's at. Maybe Teoscar comes down a little bit. There's also guys, like you mentioned, Gurriel, who's going to be better than he's been. You know, Kevin Biggio, we've talked about him on this podcast before. He had that big hit on that high 97-mile-an-hour fastball that everyone got excited about because they didn't necessarily think that was in his bat. You know, I think that even if you and I land a little bit differently on his ceiling, he's someone who's going to be better. So just because a lot of the guys, especially the top of the order, are swinging the bat well and maybe a little bit better than you expect, I don't think that means that there's going to be this huge regression crater, because there's a lot of guys in sort of the back half of that order, even including Danny Jansen, who we've jabbed at a little bit, who are going to be better than they've been so far, plus the addition of Springer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Biggio is a guy that, you know, as much as I've been on the train with everybody about being sort of down on him, or down on him, but also just curious about how he makes it work, you know, how he continues to draw all those walks the more pitchers figure out that he can't do a ton of damage. When he does damage, then that sort of puts that theory out the window. So good on him for getting that hit, and for, you know, he's looked better in the last few weeks. And to be fair, you know, he's been productive before, and also he was dealing with a hand thing after he took that ball off his hand in Kansas City, which may not have helped his power and his ability to produce exit velocity as well. I know those have historically not been great for him, but that may have colored the start of his season a little bit as well. So, you know, hopefully he's a guy who can continue to be productive like that and get to give pitchers reasons to put him on base, because that's sort of how he's gonna make his hay.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he can get those walks even without that intimidation factor a little bit, just because pitching is really hard. Like, I remember Jeff Sullivan at Fangraphs did a great series where he would do an inning with a certain pitcher's command, and he would show you, this is where the catcher set up, this is where each pitch was. And he did it with guys like Mariano Rivera. And it's still crazy, the degree to which it's not crazy because pitching is really hard. But compared to our conception watching the game, I think we think that these guys are just hitting the mitt again and again and again, and they're really not. So I think if you have that elite eye that Biggio has, there's always going to be that opportunity to work walks, because even if pitchers are trying to throw you strikes, there's no guarantee that they're going to do that.
That's true, and that's something that Tyler Chatwood said this week about moving to the first base side of the rubber, is that it allows his the arm side run that he gets on his cutter to just sort of it catches the plate, even if he misses his spot a bit better than in previous years. I think I believe that's the pitch he was talking
about. He's missed a lot of spots in his career, that's for sure.
He certainly has.
Which is not shit on Tyler Chatwood, because he's been fantastic, but historically speaking, the man has missed a lot of spots.
Not untrue.
To keep the happy vibe rolling, I mean, we could go to Nate Pearson. I'd rather just go to Alek Manoah and then let this hill just go take a dive with Nate Pearson afterwards. Let's reach the apex with Alek Manoah. I was watching his start the other night, you know, absolutely dominant. Like, it just, you know, it looks like guys don't have an answer from that that level. We're getting sort of the free Josh Tolley vibes from him at this point. Is there anything in start two that you know, changes your perception of Manoa, or is it just kind of reinforcing things you already thought?
No, I think it just reinforces the things I already thought, right? It was dominant. There wasn't as many strikeouts. He hit a guy, but
hits per nine is a three. Just for, you know, our podcast listeners, I know that they want to know that we're keeping tabs on that stat. We're at three.
That's right.
Three hit batters per nine. That's still higher than you want to see, to be honest.
A little bit. And that, you know, that maybe makes you think, okay, like, is he just so overpowering that AAA hitters he can't touch him in a way that, like, big leaguers will not be as intimidated by, and he'll, if he loses that factor, maybe that's gonna, you know, cause some bumps for him that he obviously isn't gonna get at AAA. But, you know, I don't need to see a lot of starts from him to feel pretty good about where he's at, especially considering what I expect to see from Anthony Kay coming up, which I would love to see Anthony Kay pitch really well. But I think that, you know, by the time the second half of the year rolls around, it's Ryu, Ray, Matz, Manoa, and Pearson are pretty clearly your top five starters for the Jays, which are a pretty good top five. I'm ready for that. I'm saying the second half of the season. I think Manoa could be up sooner than that for sure, especially Ross Atkins out there watching him and watching him look real good. I'm sure have much insight into this as you wrote about this and watched the game quite closely. I can't say that I really did. I looked more at your piece and then some highlights, but
yeah, the thing that stood out for me, I mean, you know, the fastball is there. It's got big velocity. We know that he works right up at the top of the zone with it, which is what you're supposed to do when you got that big fastball like that. Like, there are a couple of bats that stood out to me. He's facing Yasmani Tomas. I know not a great hitter anymore, but a former 30 home run guy in the major leagues. And he just threw him three fastballs in the exact same spot, and he just swung through all three of them. And it was just sort of one of that, you know, that was in the second inning. It was an early moment of like, okay, this is, this guy's blowing people away. And then the slider, one thing that's interesting about it is that he seemed to work it, at least in this start, like front door a lot. Like, he would bring it across the body of right-handed hitters and they would end up kind of jumping away or flinching. And he got a lot of called strikes with it. He got a couple of called strikeouts with it. There was one at bat, he literally threw it four times in a row. And on the first pitch, the guy jumped back from it. I'm like, okay. And then on the fourth pitch, he jumped back the exact same way, even though it was the exact same pitch, and he had seen it three times in a row. So that kind of tells you about the level of deception there is there. With Manoa, you know, there's the worries of, is the changeup a big enough pitch? Does that mean that left-handers might have an ability to kind of get the jump on him early in his career if they're able to catch up to the fastball? There's some valid concerns. We aired some of them out on last episode of the podcast, but it is pretty clear that you're not going to need that many more starts from him to be confident he has the stuff to get big league hitters out. And then the other stuff is, you know, is his command ability to turn over lineups and stuff. And we might not learn that from AAA, to be honest. So he could start a few more times, but we wouldn't necessarily, it takes more than 5-10 starts probably to get a firm grip of what a pitcher's command is. So we're not going to 100% know. I have a question here. I don't want to throw around friend of the show too easily as we get started here. It could lose its value, but I'm going to give a friend of the show to Michael Hode at Yahoo Sports, who posed me this question. So I thought I would just steal it and use it on the podcast. Thanks, Hode. The over-under on Alec Manoa starts at AAA, he put it at 6.5. What do you think about that line? And then we could also talk about that line for career starts at AAA, which might be a more interesting question, or starts at AAA before he gets the initial call-up.
Yeah, I think the career line is interesting because I'm definitely taking the under, even if we're including the two he's already made. Like,
yeah,
six,
I'm so, thinking I mean, like five, that would be my guess.
Yeah, I mean, Pearson had 18 innings in AAA before they first called him up. And, you know, that was vast, obviously, but at some point, like, what more do you need to see? And they could be at that point already. I think that would be a bit soon. But if he goes out and has another start like these first two, like, he's too good for AAA at that point, I think. I know three starts isn't a lot either. But, yeah, I think 3-5 is more where I would land. But I think you're right that it's an interesting question career-wise because, you know, it's – as we've seen with Pearson, it's not necessarily going to be just a linear development thing where he hits the big leagues and takes off and does the same thing. You know, maybe it's just harder to force yourself to trust your stuff against big league hitters as it is against AAA hitters. And who knows what's going on with Pearson? I don't want to like armchair diagnose anything there, but other than the mechanical stuff that we can see. But yeah, I think Manoah, it shouldn't shock anybody when any, especially a pitcher, but when any minor leaguer, you know, doesn't take to the big leagues right at the first try.
Yeah, I would cop out and take the over there because I think you probably get a rehab start at some point in his career,
okay,
or two.
Yeah.
Even if everything goes smoothly, he'll probably end up there at some point. But yeah, I think it's an interesting question. I probably would have set the line at 4.5 myself. My thought is that if he has, like, if he continues to dominate this way, maybe 4 starts. And if he has a bump in the road in start 3, but then has 2 more dominant starts, 4 or 5, I think he could still be on track for that. I've generally been a voice of caution just overall in terms of liking to have samples on guys, but his development is happening really quickly, and there's a difference between succeeding at AAA and totally dominating AAA. And I think even Nate Pearson was a guy who more succeeded at AAA than had this level of total, like, annihilation of opponents.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think some of the lower levels, yes, Pearson dominated, but AAA was just like, okay, he's fine, and then they brought him up. So we shall see. And also, I mean, I don't know if we talked about this last week, because we talked about these guys a lot last week, which is so strange, but
it's not our fault. It's our fault who's in the news cycle, okay? Like, we could have a whole podcast about Travis Bergen because we want to do it, but I don't think you guys would be too interested.
But yeah, like Keith Law talked about on a podcast the other week about, you know, he thought he was the best college pitcher in the draft when he was drafted in 2019. And that he's 2 years out from that, and that's about the time that you would expect, and that had a lot of it not been hidden away at the alt site. The development path that he's on is pretty traditional. It's not as outlandish. It's not as wild as people seem to think, even though they look at the small pro innings total. And obviously, we're seeing it in the results at AAA. Like, so those hitters can't touch him. It's time for him to be challenged at the next level, and I think the fact that the Jays have a need for it at the big leagues just makes it make all the more sense.
Yeah, it's a little different with a hitter too, right? I think if Jordan Groshans, for instance, had kind of emerged out of the alt site and suddenly dominated AA, moved up to AAA and knocked on the door, I think that would be a little bit harder for people to wrap their head around, because it's all about getting these guys at bats and how competitive are those at bats against people who are your teammates who you've seen a million times at the alt site. But when it comes to pitching, you know, a lot of it is about stuff, and it's not really it's almost not about the interplay between you and the opponent as much as what can you with your arm generate. And it's very clear that what Manoah can generate is stuff that's hard to hit. And I don't think he needs quite as many reps as, you know, a hitter needs to be ready for the next level of pitching.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was looking back because, like, Bo Bichette, if you look at the numbers that he put up in AAA, I think did he break his arm or something like that? Or he had an injury in the year that he got called up. I don't know if that was 2019 as well. But if you look at his AAA numbers, they're not super impressive, which is, I think, because of exactly what you're saying. You're more looking at the quality of at-bats, and you're looking at other things, and you know, you can't. A hitter can go on a tear, or a hitter can have, you know, bad luck, and the numbers may not bear out what he really is, in the same way that, yeah, you can look at Manoah and a guy like that and just be like, okay, that stuff's going to play.
He's got the ball and he's doing bad things with it, so get him up. Speaking of guys who have fit that description in the past, it's time to, yeah, come down off the high and give a couple of minutes to Nate Pearson, because I don't know if, like, you know, his brief appearance in the major leagues was about as bad as an appearance can be. I mean, obviously there have been worse ones in the history of baseball, but when you're talking about, you know, not making it through 3 innings and not striking anyone out and those walk totals and just, you know, that kind of scattershot inability to find the zone completely, putting hitters in good counts, everything that you can do negatively as a pitcher, he did in that outing. I don't know if that makes me think too differently about him as a pitcher, because one, you know, I think almost anyone can lay an egg. The greats can lay an egg. You know, the way he's kind of built himself back up from the injuries seems like it's been, there hasn't been that much. You know, he's just had that one AAA start and this start, and he didn't get deep into the AAA start, so maybe you need more time. I think the better question is not, like, is Nate Pearson still good? I think both of us would agree Nate Pearson is still good. I think we'd both be hopeful about his future. It's, I think it's, is the way the Blue Jays handled this the correct way to handle it? Because should you bring Nate Pearson up in a situation where one bad outing is going to get him sent down?
Yeah, that would be the question. I mean, obviously they didn't expect him to pitch the way that he did, so maybe that changed the equation a bit. But yeah, it's I was writing about it yesterday and looking at, you know, where he was at, where the timeline was, because something Jeff Ware, the Buffalo pitching coach, said is that, you know, it's kind of still spring training for him, which is accurate. Like, he's at the point, you know, they got him built back up after the injury, but he's really, you know, he was at 50 pitches the same amount of days ago from, or the same amount of days between being at 50 pitches and his start on Sunday as about Ryu when he was at 50 pitches in the spring and his opening day start, right? Like, sort of the similar timeline there. And that's Ryu, and that's a guy who's, you know, more, you know, comfortable with what he does and you know, obviously much more experienced and not dealing with, you know, tweaking his mechanics to try to be less violent, quote unquote. And so, yeah, I think that we could definitely question the readiness of Pearson to have stepped into that spot. And I'm maybe too soft on the team for stuff like this. Like, I get it. I understand the impulse to be like, yeah, sure, let's see what he can do. Especially if they don't think that it's going to be like a confidence issue for him. I think that kind of stuff gets overblown a bit with fans who just think that these are, you know, I mean, obviously they're humans, but I think he understands the business quite well from anything we've ever heard from Nate Pearson, and isn't going to lose belief in himself or his stuff by getting sent back down after one bad outing. But, you know, if they'd had any other option, which I guess, you know, they could have gone with another bullpen day. It would have been just one game. We still probably would have been having a wonderful week as we are. But yeah, I think there's absolutely room to scrutinize that decision to bring him up that early.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, I don't think that Nate Pearson's confidence is totally shot. Last week, I said that, you know, it's okay to bring Pierce up relatively quickly because maybe he can only give you four innings and that's fine because it's sort of just a bullpen day light. And so at the time, I didn't have an issue with them bringing him up, and I realized that he was a little bit, yeah, maybe wasn't fully cooked from a building himself up, and he could do that at the big league level. Obviously, like the team, I didn't imagine he would pitch this poorly. I do think that Ross Atkins talks a lot about guys being ready and him wanting to bring them up and not have to send them down again, and I know it's not the end of the world, and like you said, progress isn't totally linear with these guys, but I just think that when you're talking about a Nate Pearson or an Alek Manoah, or, you know, when the time comes, an Austin Martin, there's guys who are a little, you know, they're just a cut above the other guys, and there should be a little bit more rope with them. Like, I wouldn't have, if he had pitched like that and they said, you know, that was a disaster of an outing, but we're going to roll him out 5 days from now, I wouldn't have had a problem with that. Like, I probably would have scrutinized that less than them saying, let's bring him up and then bring him down, and then who knows when they bring him back up again. Like, it's very easy for a season to become a lost season when you have that kind of bumpiness in it. And I think that when you have a guy who's a pitching prospect of that caliber, it's okay to give him a little bit more rope. I know they're trying to win now, and if it had been, I don't know, three outings and they'd all gone poorly, maybe it's a different conversation. But one outing for them to totally kind of abandon a plan when plans and sort of, they are so important with these guys, you kind of lay out, this is what we want to do. It just seemed a little bit scattered for me for one outing to totally throw off their idea of what they want to do with Pearson.
Yeah, I think that's fair too. I think, you know, you react to the circumstances that are in front of you. And I could see also being like, one start in the minors is probably not going to be enough, so we might as well send him down. And I'm with you. I would have been totally fine. I kind of expected them to be like, well, we'll see how it goes next time around and keep him in the big leagues. So that definitely is surprising, and I don't know how much we can read into what that means that they would do that to him. But obviously, they saw what we saw, and it was pretty bad. And he does need, obviously, and because this has been an issue with him before, it's so weird because he was pitching through something obviously last year, like he was really great at the start, and then it seemed like he was kind of hiding some discomfort that he was having before he went on the IL. So it's you kind of have to take some of those bad outings last year with a grain of salt. But he did. He's had times where, the mechanics get off and he can't get them back on track, and he can't like self-correct. And, even with the pitching coaches, with Pete Walker's advice or whatever, he can't. And that's something that I think he needs to do, especially if they're going to continue to be tough for him to repeat at this stage. And, in time, this is why nobody's, jumping off the bandwagon or thinking he's not a problem. Like, in time, he will just be able to repeat better. Repetition will help him, and experience will help him. He's just sort of in that stage now where the experience isn't there and the repetition isn't there. So yeah, it's weird to know what to do with him, especially when you have such a need at the big league level and you see what what he's capable of doing. He's obviously got the stuff to get big leaguers out when he's at his best. But yeah, it's really. I don't know. I understand why they got so scared by that outing that they're like, no, we better really dial this back instead of just trying to put a smiling face on it and go forward and hope for the best in the next outing. But you hate to see them have to do it.
It is odd because I think when you sort of zoom out from the situation, we're looking at it at the end of the year, for instance, you'll say, oh, he had one kind of promising-ish start in AAA. And then he had one terrible start in the big leagues, and then he went to AAA for a bunch of time. I don't know how long that's going to be, but I assume that they're going to want to see some consistency from him now. Like, I don't think this is he has one start in AAA and now he does really well, and they're like, oh, it's all good now. I assume we're going to see him try and establish some consistency before they bring him back, especially if Manoah ends up going the other way. And so
I think Manoah will be up before Pearson's back. That's a guess, obviously, but I don't think that's.
No, I think that I would agree with that. I'd agree with that guess. So it is weird when you look at Pearson's whole season, you'll see a timeline where one bad start in the big leagues resulted in a far longer time in the minors than you would think. But again, it's we'll see how it plays out. I'm still very high on Nate Pearson. I'm very confident in what he can do as a pitcher. Like we were talking with Manoah, you can see the stuff, what he's capable of producing with that arm. He's unbelievably talented. So when you mention that like future Blue Jays rotation that has the three guys that are going for them now, plus Manoah, plus Pearson, like that's not hard to envision. The only thing that makes it hard to envision is just injuries, because injuries happen. Mm-hmm. And we're dealing with people coming off this weird 2020, and God knows who's going to be available by the time it's August, September.
Yeah, and what I will say, though, I guess about the one start thing is that it's also, yes, it was one start, obviously, but it was also, like, multiple innings and multiple, like, chats and multiple chances to get it back together and then lose it again. And I think if it was, like, he had one wobble in the game and had the same line, which could have easily happened, like it would have, that would be maybe less concerning than like it just unraveling every time he went out onto the mound, like every inning that he was asked to pitch, that even with when there were moments of promise and when there were moments where it was like, oh, okay, he found the zone with that one, it would still just not quite get there. But I don't know. I do think clearly he will benefit from some consistency in the minors, and probably should have been given that before they brought him up, if they were going to be giving him such a short leash, as you say.
I've framed most of the talking points in this episode around sort of positive, negative. This one is kind of ambivalent, I guess, for me, is the sort of the news that broke the other day that the Oakland Athletics are potentially threatening to relocate. Now, how seriously to take this story is part of the story. And I think a lot of people aren't taking this story particularly seriously, because a lot of people see this as the club's attempt to essentially extort close to $1 billion from the city in public funding. And for a lot of people, that is the beginning and end of it. And there, I believe there's validity to that. But once in a while, we get the opportunity to talk about Montreal and Vancouver and yeah. the hope that springs eternal there that baseball can return. I know that I went to university in Montreal. Like, I have a great deal of love for that city. We remember, you know, the Expos and the Blue Jays Exhibition Series and how much fun that was. Do you think that fans of these places should have any kind of hope for, I don't know what the time span is. Let's not go with the exact time span yet. I have a question on that later. But if you're living in Vancouver or Montreal, is this news something that registers with you, or is this news just sort of more political bullshit that you'd put to the side?
Probably the latter. I mean, Vancouver obviously could be a big league city for sure. I think baseball would be foolish to ignore Vancouver, but doesn't seem to be on the radar in the same way as, say, you know, Portland or Charlotte or Austin or Vegas or a bunch of American cities, which I think will probably get looked to first. Montreal obviously has other things going on, but I think the A's being in the West maybe doesn't affect them, even if you are allowing yourself to be affected by it. But mostly I think it is just that it's that stadium power play that the team didn't even seem to really want to do. Like, I think there were reports that, you know, Manfred said, you know, they just had it in their back pocket. Like, at some point, if you need to, the commissioner's office is going, you know, will be behind you in trying to extort this money to try to get a better stadium deal, which is what we see happen. And, you know, I know that the Expos moved. That obviously was a different situation and a situation that had sort of been left to rot on the vine for a very, very long time. But you also see, you know, I think, you know, the classic Canadian sports writer mistake is to bring things back to hockey. But I think about, you know, the way that Hamilton has been teased by about the prospect of an NHL team for a long time, though that's gone away, I think, in recent years. But also, like, just the fight that Gary Bettman put up to keep the Phoenix Coyotes or the Arizona Coyotes in that market, you know, to for absolutely no reason, just a terrible situation there. I don't understand why they've been so insistent on making it work. I don't
Austin Matthews is still in the NHL, and they have hope that he'll come there someday and totally change everything in Arizona.
But I think that, to me, that gives some insight into what leagues really probably think about relocation more than, I know, I guess the NFL's had some relocation, but that's the NFL. But I think that the insistence on not losing that market, I think, is telling, and that the league probably just doesn't want to do that. I think I don't understand why they don't expand. I think expansion could help in a lot of ways. I think that, you know, the expansion fees will be enormous because that's just what the values of teams are. I think watering down the player pool couldn't hurt, you know, considering some of the issues that we have in the game. And, you know, you sort of always see at post-expansion hitting numbers go up, which is what the league is looking to do lately.
Not very successfully.
Not very successfully at all. Oh my God. But yeah, so I would think that Montreal's hope is more there and in whatever the hell the Rays are doing. That whole thing, which I, you know, just completely didn't take seriously at first, and now can't take my eyes off it whenever news breaks about what's going on there, which I think is very similar in that, you know, there's real estate deals to be made and there's a whole backstory of, you know, what's going on with, you know, with the Rays trying to make use of that property and where the Trop is and the city or whoever has the rights to it. And there's, you know, it would be unsurprising if it ended up, you know, with a new stadium deal in Tampa and Montreal on the outside looking in. But I think that there's some hope there. I think Vancouver less.
The one thing that, and it's interesting because I think a lot of times we take our impression of public sentiment from Twitter. It's just natural. Mm-hmm. If you're on the platform a lot and you see the news and you see people reacting to the news. And it's important to remember that what's going on Twitter is not necessarily reflective of what's going on in the real life minds, especially of voters. I think that's something that we've seen over a long period of time, is that the discourse on Twitter is not necessarily reflective of a lot of voters. But it does seem that the appetite for public funds to go towards stadiums is declining slightly. And it does seem that people are having their eyes opened a little bit to how silly it is for cities to be pouring in these massive amounts of money to sports franchises to help billionaires build their, you know, their stadiums. And as a result, there is a slight sliver for me of thinking maybe that this time it'll be different. Like there's a little bit of a chance in my eyes that, you know, maybe, I don't know if it's Oakland or Tampa Bay. I don't know if MLB will be the one where it happens. But I think that there's a chance that in the next few years, there's a situation like this where a team tries to extort a city for a bunch of money to build something like this. And the city kind of pushes back and says, this is not really what the people want. And they don't want us spending this much money on something like this. And especially when a lot of the proceeds are just going to go into some billionaire's pocket. Now, the flip side of that is the places they're going to be expanding to, those places will then have a harder time building stadiums. So I don't know if it's going to lead directly to an outcome where there's more people moving around. But I do think that public sentiment has moved a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. But though also, you know, you may see cities trying to entice teams away, right? When there's an unstable situation like this. I mean, Atlanta's different, but like Cobb County, offering money to have the Braves move north, which I assume they wanted to do anyway. But you know, different jurisdictions can have play against each other within their own local markets, and that's another thing in Tampa too, right? Like the Rays are in St. Pete, they wanted to build a stadium in Tampa. There's all sorts of different levels of government all over the place. The Jays, as we know, work with the Dunedin government, and they got themselves a whole lot of public money, which Dunedin seems very happy about. And they, you know, pretty much, I don't know if there's a study that has ever said, yeah, you put this much money into a stadium and this meant this much, you're going to get this much income and revenue from
tourism.
You
probably don't. My guess is you don't.
Yeah, they all say it's a terrible idea, like, to give this money away.
It's very sort of trickle-down economics, right? It's like, if you spend this money on these people that have a bunch of money, everything's going to work out.
But they seem real happy about it, or at least, you know, the people that get interviewed in the papers, which are like the business leaders. So obviously they're colored. And the Blue Jays one is especially egregious because they clearly put all the money into the player development complex, and like the stadium got a new coat of paint. But like, it's better, but like clearly a lot of money went into the other site that is just like closed off to the public. But obviously the big thing was to keep the Jays in town. But yeah, well, it wouldn't stop me from buying an Oakland A's jersey at this point, and it wouldn't make me buy a Montreal Expos jersey.
A's and Rays gear is safe to buy. I know we've got a lot of A's and Rays fans who listen to the podcast. I want you guys to know it's safe to buy that gear. My question on this then is, if you got $100 burning a hole in your pocket and you're desperate to lay it down on something, what kind of odds would you need to feel comfortable putting it on an MLB franchise coming to Montreal or Vancouver in the next 15 years? You can split up Montreal and Vancouver if you want, or you can use them as one. So let's say I gave you 10-1 odds. Would you be willing to throw down that $100?
On Montreal, yes. On Vancouver, love you, but no, I don't think that's happening anytime soon. But Montreal, maybe I'm just an optimist. Maybe I just want an excuse to go move to Montreal, but like,
don't we all?
Right? It seems like there's something there. Like they really have a movement, and they really have, you know, big time money people involved and invested. They already have, you know, land that they're looking at, which I don't, you know, who knows how concrete any of that stuff is until they actually put a shovel in the ground or, you know, get a team at first. But I can still see it happening, though. Also, at the same time, the Blue Jays, and I'm sure MLB as well, loves this thing where the Jays are Canada's team, and that's part of the whole Mark Shapiro project, right? Is that, you know, we can be a behemoth, quote unquote,
I don't know if you're going to win.
In part because
you can be Canada's team, but you're not necessarily going to win over tons of Quebec. You know what I mean? I just don't think that there's...
That's fair.
I think that Montreal and Toronto, I mean, you know, we both have our thumbs on the scales, right? Because we both like to see this happen. But trying to speak somewhat objectively, I don't think that a team in Montreal is going to siphon off too much Blue Jays support, except probably in parts of Atlantic Canada. Like, we're talking about New Brunswick. Yeah. And, yeah, parts of Atlantic Canada overall will be closer to Montreal to visit the stadium and, you know, might, depending on the state of the Jays, be tired of the Jays at that point and look for an opportunity to jump ship, especially if it's the ends up being the Rays, if they have a good brain trust and all that. But, yeah, I don't know. So if I brought those odds down to 5-1, would that change your answer?
That would, I think, change my answer. That's tougher. And the optimist in me and the person who, like you say, wants to see it happen, I would probably still make that bet, but I would have to be like very willing to accept that my $100 is never coming back.
Yeah, okay. So we're sitting between a 20% and a 10% confidence in MLB in Montreal for 15 years. I don't know if that makes us more confident than the average person or less. Maybe more than people outside Montreal and maybe less than some people inside Montreal. I know everyone wants to see it happen. Everyone wants to see, you know, the Leafs and Habs are having their first playoff series in forever coming up. I think that's a lot of fun. I think people would love to see an Expos Blue Jays rivalry. The Blue Jays don't have a great rivalry in the AL East or just in baseball in general. The Texas thing is flamed out. The Rays thing doesn't really have much animosity, as Montoyo and Cash are basically best friends, and then and half those games have to take place in the Trop, and then Baltimore, who cares, and Yankees and Red Sox, you're just not gonna force your way into that one. So
yeah, it's hard to be a rival when the other team's fans do not care about you at all.
Montreal is probably the Blue Jays' best hope to have an incredibly compelling rival someday.
I've heard people being like, no, they got to be in the National League, you know, that's crazy.
It seems like the
Expos in the AL East would be amazing.
Like a terrible idea.
That would be the value.
Okay, yeah. Before we wrap this up, we're going to do a little quick look ahead to the weekend series. That we did this last week, and I feel like it's part of what we promised as the concept of the podcast. is there anything that really stands out to you this week? I mentioned my notes here. Chase Anderson starting is like the worst remember some guy's old friend I can imagine. Like, he was bad with the Jays, but not historically bad. He didn't have really any memorable moments. I don't think you care to see him pitch against your team, and he's not quite bad enough where you're like, oh, this is gonna be great, they're gonna crush Chase Anderson. He's not good, but he's not quite that, like, circle the pitcher on the calendar, this is gonna be awesome guy.
Yeah, and I don't think he wasn't Tanner Roark, right? Like, he didn't have developed the animosity with Jays fans where you would circle. But I mean, gotta feel pretty good about this lineup going up against Chase Anderson. Like, I saw enough of him last year to at least know that. I'm curious about the Real Muto thing. He's on the COVID list because he didn't feel well, and I saw people suggest maybe the Phillies are you know, manipulating something. I don't know I don't know. If he doesn't play, that's a plus for the Jays, and I assume that if he's on the list that he can't, but I'm not sure what's going on
without him. It's like Bryce Harper's the fun guy to watch on the Phillies. I don't think we need to talk too much about Bryce Harper. Everyone knows you're either for or against, and we know what he brings to the table. The one guy I did want to point out before we left was Vince Velasquez, because he's someone who strikes me as like the quintessential Blue Jays trade deadline target, a guy who's on an expiring contract, really good stuff, has generally underperformed that stuff. He's the Robbie Ray. He's the Francisco Liriano before that. He's the Joaquin Benoit, even the guy who is not working out with his current team, but it's easy to envision making some tweaks and finding something with him. So if the Blue Jays are, yeah, needing that fourth, fifth starter at the trade deadline, which they probably will, and if the Phillies fall out of the NL East race, which I would also guess they probably will, that is the type of guy that I could very easily see them going after. So he's someone that maybe if you're a Blue Jays fan, you might want to take an extra long look at this weekend.
You're absolutely right. He does sort of fit the profile.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you guys for tuning in to episode 3 of Blue Jays Happy Hour. Continue to find us on all the platforms. I don't think anyone is icing us out anymore, which is great. Continue to leave reviews. I think last time I checked, we had all 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. If someone wants to come in with a 4, we'll respect that. You know, honesty is respected by us, but you know, the perfect record is cool too. Yeah, my name is Hard Luck.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.